He is here now, and we are going to have a teaching with him, and he usually will have some questions that if you'd like to ask some questions, and he usually tends to like to have you stop him. If you have a question, you can just raise your hand and ask, okay? Let's see. So we have support your teacher if you would like to. Our funding for the center is by volunteer donations only, and we have on our website, you can text to donate, which is a brand new thing that you can do, which is wonderful. And I think that is it. Did you think of anything else? Okay. Well, thank you so much. He's going to be here soon.
Good morning, everyone. Our fearless leader, Donna, has left the country, not due to anything other than traveling. So bear with us all as we figure everything out together. See if I can get all the pages right and the right chanting for the four measurables this time. So we'll begin with Shakyamuni Buddha's mantra on page 183 in the gold book, and I'm not sure what page it is in the folder, so if you know that number, you can just shout it out. I think most of you know it by now. Taya ta Now, page 34 for the English version of the four measurables in the gold book. May all sentient beings have happiness and the causes of happiness. May all sentient beings be free from suffering and the causes of suffering. May all sentient beings be inseparable from the happiness that is free from suffering. May all sentient beings abide in equanimity, free from attachment for friends and hatred for enemies. On page 37, at the very bottom, there's the four measurables. And I know they are in the folder, too, if you see it, Fran. Do you see that in there? Yeah. Okay, let's see if we can all do this together. Sem chem tam che de wa dong de we gu dong den par gu chi du nyao dong du nyao gi. Oh, it's at the very bottom, right beneath there. That's easy. Eight times for the Chen Rezi mantra. Children, would you like to lead us? How's it start? Om Mani Padme Hum. Om Mani Padme Hum. Om. Who knows the name of the next mantra that we do? What's the name of it? Tara's mantra? Okay, you want to do it? Do it. Om Tare Tu Tare Tu Re So Ha. Om Tare Tu Tare Tu So Ha. Om Tare Tu Tare Tu Re 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 So Ha. Do you guys know why we sing that on Sunday morning? who do we sing it for? To prep variables. Yeah, go with that. Would you sing it for Geshe Gelik? Do you remember what they say every morning? For his long and happy and healthy life. And he's traveling right now, so we all want to think about him and hope that he returns safely to us. So we sing that mantra for him. His teacher recommended we sing that. So that's why we sing it every Sunday morning. Okay. You may depart in peace.
So, very nice to see all of you here this morning. Thank you for coming. And there's seats up front if you need a place closer to the front. I have to start with an apology, or at least an excuse me. I seem to have developed an allergy very strongly over the last day or so. So if I have to stop and snort and blow my nose every once in a while, you'll forgive me. It's not the most graceful thing, but necessary. I know that many people who come to these Sunday morning sessions are, relatively speaking, new to Buddhism. Some are completely new. Some have just been studying just for a little while, and then there's others who are veterans. But many people here come to this class because it seems to be the one that's most designed for people who are just more or less starting to get interested in Buddhism. So what I thought I would say, what I would tell you this morning, is something about the attitude and the experiences that I had when I was a very new student. This was a millennia ago, right? Back in the 1970s, and I had been living overseas and was back in America for the first time in quite a few years. I was in my mid-20s at that time, and I was, truthfully, I was kind of anxious to leave again. I had enjoyed being overseas, and I wasn't particularly happy in being back in the States. Fortunately, it happened that I was able to go to India. I had had a little bit of interest in Buddhism up to that point, but I had never studied with any teacher. But a childhood friend of mine had been studying for a year, and I went over to join him. He was studying with the Tibetan Lama in northern India. So I went over and joined the classes that he was taking, and then stayed for the better part of 6 or 7 years, and then lived the next several decades in different Buddhist centers around the world, like England and other places in Europe and back in the United States. So what I wanted to mention was I was wondering how I would explain to my family why their son had left New Jersey to go and study in to go live in India. And it seemed to me that if I said I went there to study Buddhism, they might think I was on some kind of a religious trip, you know, that I was a religious fanatic. And I came from a very a background which really had no use for organized religion. And spirituality is something else, but to be a member of an organized religion was not considered very good, right? So I thought if I told them I'm studying Buddhism, they would think I went off the deep end, which may have been true. So instead of writing that, I said, I'm over here and I'm studying Buddhist psychology, because that kind of puts it in terms that people from an academic background, like my family and friends, would be able to relate to. So I told about that I was studying Buddhist psychology. I called it that. And I felt that I wasn't lying. I mean, I was prevaricating a little bit, you know, but I thought that by saying I was studying Buddhist psychology, I was really telling them what I actually was doing on the inside. Because for me, the aspect of Buddhism that grabbed me, that intrigued me tremendously, in addition to the extraordinary teachings they have on loving kindness and compassion, was the very, very profound understanding about the nature of the mind, which of course is the subject of psychology, and not just a scientific description of the workings of the mind, but how the mind can be improved, how the qualities that are present in our awareness, in our consciousness, that are negative and destructive and harmful can be reduced and eventually eliminated. I mean, after 40 years, I'm still working on the reduction part. The elimination, that's going to be another lifetime, right? And how the positive qualities can be generated, increased. So because that was really what intrigued me the most about Buddhism, when I said I was studying Buddhist psychology, I felt I was being truthful, even though I was actually trying to avoid saying something that would upset my parents. Okay. And of the many different teachings concerning the nature of the mind and the experience that comes from various types of mind, one of the things that struck me very powerfully was the notion that when any strong mood or emotion arises in us, right, and we can focus on for a moment on the negative, destructive emotions. You know, when the positive ones come up, we can kind of more or less leave them alone. If they're not doing us harm, they're doing us good. But it's when the negative ones arise that that suffering and dissatisfaction follow. And so of these negative states of mind, obviously the most dramatic of them all is hatred, right? But there's many, many other ones as well, such as greed, arrogance, and a certain fundamental ignorance and not knowing of the relation of the nature of reality. So when these negative, destructive states of mind, such as hatred, arises, according to the teachings that really caught my interest, this arisal of this emotion doesn't come from nowhere. It doesn't just arise full blown. You know, some of you know the Greek myth of how Athena appeared full grown from the head of Zeus, right? Well, our emotions aren't like that. It isn't like, you know, we're just sort of strolling along and then suddenly this powerful emotion like of hatred just arises and takes it over. Sometimes it appears that way. But the reason it appears that way is that we haven't really paid attention to the antecedents, to the states of mind that preceded it. But in Buddhist psychology, there's very profound teachings to see what state of mind is conducive for the arrival of the negative emotions and which ones are conducive for the arrival of the positive emotions. Because these, generally speaking, until we start paying attention to them, are quite hidden. Okay? So, let's think of a situation in which we're just walking down the streets in the city or somewhere where there's people around, and we chance upon somebody. We can even use the example of somebody that we don't know, right? But when we look at this person, and I'll say it's a man, it could be a woman, but to make it simple, it's a man that we see. We start to feel uneasy somehow. And not because this person has done anything bad to us or that we really know anything about this person, but there's something about the way he looks or carries himself or walks or whatever it might be, which starts to arouse this uncomfortable feeling. And it may manifest itself by feeling a little bit protective, you know, like defensive, as if this person who's just walking along is suddenly going to attack us, you know, physically or verbally. Right? It might be something like that, and we start feeling a little bit protective, as if we're starting to build a wall around ourselves, you know, protect us from whatever this person might do or say bad to us. Right? And then if this this feeling, initially a kind of a defensiveness, a kind of an irritation, an uneasiness, if that grows, then it may give rise to anger and even to hatred. And if that grows, then it may start manifesting. Up to now, everything's been happening inside our own head. But if it manifests more strongly than that, then we might say something. We may go on the attack, kind of preemptive attack. Before this guy attacks me, I'm going to attack him, you know? So we might say something kind of nasty or sarcastic, or if we're motivated strongly enough, we might even bump into this person. There are seats up in the front if you're okay? Okay. So, where did all this come from? Where did all this irritation and defensiveness and anger and hatred, that whole spectrum of possible emotions, where did it come from? Especially considering that this person is a stranger to us. Oh, yeah.
Are we holding on to anybody we've met in the past?
Oh, just to say, while this is happening, just to mention to everyone, because this is being recorded, putting in a time capsule and sent to the moon or Mars or wherever, then the sound, when people say things from the audience, they have to wait for a moment until they get the microphone, because otherwise what you say doesn't get recorded.
Aren't we basing our judgments on what we feel about this person based on things that we've internalized that have happened to us?
Mm.
So that person is the last 10 people that may have hurt you?
It can be that. We could be carrying over an unpleasant situation because we just we're walking back from work and the boss yelled at us for not doing our work properly, and we're kind of carrying that anger and that upsetness with us, for example, and we're just taking it out on the next person that we see. It could be something like that.
I mean, like, even over a period of years, say if somebody was abused as a child.
Yeah. Okay, that's getting into a deeper view. Okay, those are very good points, right? So what was being said was that we're not just a blank slate as we walk through our life. We are carrying with us the accumulation of experiences. And if we've had repeated heavy negative experiences, then we are we're very apt to react in all this defensive, irritated, angry, hatred way. Not just what the boss happened to say to us earlier that day, but all of the heavy things that have happened to us in our life. And this becomes very significant when we start thinking about our childhood, because when we're children, we don't really have yet the understanding or the ability to filter out all the messages we're receiving. So there are, unfortunately, many, many children in this world, the messages that they repeat over and over again from their parents, from other adults, from their teachers, is, you're no good, you're worthless, you're stupid, you're ugly, right? And the kid has no way of doing a reality assessment as to whether any of these judgments are valid, but it keeps hearing them, it keeps internalizing them, and then is anything but a blank slate from that moment onwards, is carrying around that negative self-image. So that kind of thing can definitely be true, and very sadly affects quite a lot of people who carry around this very strong inferiority complex, or a feeling of worthlessness or self-loathing. So there is a case, a more extreme a case than I was going to start with, but it's a very good example of where there's already a thought pattern present. When this person who's now a grown-up, is now us, walking along, right, and we encounter someone, we're on a hair trigger. We're ready to respond with some kind of negative, destructive emotion because of all of that programming. Okay? So then why is it that a person who is, in fact, we don't know at all, who's a complete stranger, how does that person become the trigger for any of these negative emotions? Because he or she didn't do anything to us, right? So what might be a cause for us to react so strongly to this person? Yes, in the middle there.
A lot of us don't know, but we could be emotional empaths, mental empaths, or even physical empaths. I'm a really strong emotional in chakras, and we hold on to energy, and I can read people's chakras and know what emotions they hold on to, and we hold on to negative emotions, we need to release them, and I'm able to do that. So when we interact with somebody that, like she said, has the negative energy that you're feeling, but you don't know why, it's in your chakras, it's in your body, and that's how we know. And it's a defense mechanism for us to stay away from that person, or, you know, maybe understand why we don't like that person so that we can heal from ourselves, from our past.
Okay. So that's interesting. That's approaching all of this on quite a subtle level. Some people here aren't familiar with terms chakra and so forth. This has to do with our inner psychic nervous system. And for a teacher like myself in a class like this, that's getting into an area which is a little bit too subtle. So I want to keep it on the level of our ordinary experience that we can recognize without having the training that this gentleman is talking about of being able to observe what's happening in this subtle system. So someone else raised their hand when I asked what reason there might be why we have a strong reaction to someone who actually we don't know. Yes, sir.
I think that a lot of our opinions are shaped by the media that we pay attention to.
Mm-hmm.
And we get
mm-hmm.
so indoctrinated.
Mm-hmm.
You've got, you know, half the country watching one network and half the country watching the other. And we create mm-hmm. these opinions and definitions about people that we don't even know.
Uh-huh.
And we start believing that it's true, and we kind of mm-hmm. react that way. And I think that, you know, we've ended up with a very polarized nation as a result of that.
That's I think what was just said was very, very true, and is actually very, very close to the idea I had in my mind when I posed that question, because that was from the point of view of media input, right? But it doesn't even have to be from the media. We receive input and messages from all sorts of directions, and one of the things that you said that I think has put the finger right on the pulse of this experience is that we have an idea, we have a pre-existing idea about other people, even about people we haven't met. In other words, we're ready to call this person good or this person bad just because of such superficial reasons as a slight resemblance to someone who belongs to a group that we don't like. Why we don't like that group is based on everything from past experience we had with somebody, or what the media is telling us, or how we were brought up in our family. You know, that's kind of where those original messages came from. But now that we're carrying them, it all it requires is for us to see someone who resembles someone that we have been taught not to like, someone who we have been taught to think that's a bad person, that's a dangerous person, that's someone you should avoid, and we're ready to project that image of badness onto whoever seems to be an appropriate recipient. Okay, so it could be superficial as the color of their skin or the color of their hair or their ethnicity, or the football team that they cheer for. It could be almost any kind of trigger. But if it makes us think that the person that we're seeing is a member of them, as opposed to a member of us, right? Then we're ready to project onto it all these negative feelings and negative emotions. Does that make some sense? Yeah. So the way I've quoted this before, but I don't think it was during one of the Sunday classes, so if I'm repeating myself, please excuse me. But there was a teaching by His Holiness the Dalai Lama, which I saw on YouTube a while ago, and in it he was giving a very brief definition of the Buddhist approach or the Buddhist method. And the words he used was the Buddhist approach is to use our maximum intelligence to be able to transform our negative emotions. Okay, the maximum intelligence to transform negative emotions. And this doesn't mean that an emotion arises and then you clamp down on it by just some thinking about it, right? It means to recognize what the thinking is that's going on, that we're often not aware of, that's leading us in the direction of having these negative, destructive emotions. So, if we see someone who becomes a trigger for us to generate this really strong irritation and anger and even hatred, if we see someone like that, we've already made a decision, not necessarily, and very often not necessarily a conscious decision. It's often a decision that's kind of under the level of full conscious awareness, but we've made a decision that person is somehow or other bad. You know? That's a bad person. Right? And because we feel that person is bad from his or her own side, we feel somehow justified for being defensive, irritated, angry, giving rise to hatred, aggression, and so forth, as a way of dealing with the badness of the other person. Now, of course, when we're walking down the street and these negative emotions start arising in relationship to someone we've never met, you know, then where does this feeling come from that this person is bad? You know, we've not run into this person before, so why are we making this projection? And it should be pointed out again, you know, that this projection of badness onto this person isn't something that we generally are aware of. It's happening on a very, very subliminal level. And it can, as indicated, it can happen for any number of very superficial reasons, because this person resembles somebody that we've had a bad contact with in the past. And so we assume that because he or she resembles that person, that there's some badness there. Right? Whereas if we see someone who reminds us of our best friend, you know, by the way this person walks or acts or speaks or their tone of voice or their accent or their face or their figure or whatever it might be, there's some superficial resemblance to someone we like, we're automatically predisposed. Why? Because we're projecting the idea of goodness onto that person because they resemble somebody who has been good for us in the past. So if we're projecting a badness onto an object, onto a person, we're geared up for one of these destructive emotions, you know, like all the ones I've been mentioning, from irritation to hatred. You know, this wariness, this defensiveness, this getting ready to be aggressive. Whereas if someone appears good, somehow or other seems to be a fit receptacle for us projecting good onto them, then we're primed to act in ways which begin to accept the humanity of that person. You know, because everyone in the world, without exception, is in a sense like a multifaceted diamond. It means we have many different faces, many different attributes, right? And if a person appears to us as bad, very often we think they're wholly bad, every facet of their being. Because actually, this, from our point of view, this person only has one facet. You know, the ugly face, the aggressive face, the angry face, the face that makes me upset, right? But to somebody else, let's say that person probably has a close friend. When that close friend looks at that same person, is that person viewed through the facet of this ugliness and aggressiveness and badness? No. The friend views, you know, remembers all the good things that person has done, or the nice things or the supportive things, and sees goodness. So the question sometimes comes down to, well, who's right and who's wrong? The person who sees that person is all bad, is that the right view? The person who sees them as all good, based on a few similarities, is that right? You know, I think the answer is that as long as we remain oblivious to the fact that we all have many, many good points and bad points, things that are strong, things that are weak, things that are helpful, things that are harmful, as long as we don't keep that in mind, that we're all multifaceted human beings, then we're ready to just project, based on one quality, we're ready to paint that person, that quality completely, 100%. So if the person appears to be just a little bit bad, we think he's completely bad. That person has no good qualities. And we feel justified for our defensiveness, our anger, and so forth. And on the other hand, if this person just has one good quality that attracts our attention, like this superficial resemblance to a close friend of ours, we're primed to paint that person completely good, even though he or she may have some very weak, you know, annoying qualities, but because they're not immediately, because they're not the first qualities that we see, right, we become prejudiced. So what all of this is saying is actually based on, or is deeply related to one of the prayers that everybody recites here Sunday morning. You know, there's this four immeasurable prayers, immeasurable love and compassion and joy, and one of them is equanimity. With true equanimity, we recognize that all the beings that we share this planet with are multifaceted. So there's no reason for dividing the world into groups and saying everyone in this group, you know, these are the people who watch the TV network that I don't watch. You know, I watch the one that agrees with my political opinions, but this person probably watches the one that is completely wrong and agrees with the opinions on that other stupid television network, right? So that this people and people in that group, I don't like them. They're bad, they're stupid, they're ignorant, they're this, they're that. Completely denying the fact that in that group there are people who, if we got to know, we could easily become friends with. So there's no, instead of having some sense of equanimity, of recognizing this many levels of being, we hold on to our prejudicial view and view the people in that group as wholly negative. And we exaggerate that negative quality. Right? It leads to what Lama Tsongkhapa said in his teachings was an overestimation. We see something as a little bit bad, and we overestimate that. We exaggerate that into real badness, real ugliness, something that justifies my harmful emotion. Right? And then the same thing true, if we see something that's just a little bit good, that has a little bit of an attractive quality to it, then our tendency, lacking any kind of equanimity, is to exaggerate that. And now this person is wholly good, you know, is wonderful. And we start overlooking the qualities that if we had been paying close attention to, we might see are less than attractive, right? Because we're exaggerating. So to those beings that we have a negative feeling for, we hold on to them with an exaggerated feeling of distance. You know, I want to put those people away from me because in some way or other, they're bad, they're ugly, they're untrustworthy, they're dishonest, etc., etc., etc. Whereas the people in this group, you know, feel kind of attracted to, then we exaggerate their qualities, and in that exaggeration, we often develop a similarly but opposite unrealistic view. We think, oh, since this person looks kind of nice and speaks kind of nice, he must be really intelligent, you know, must be a really nice person. We kind of exaggerate the goodness as if they have no weak points. And the problem with that, I mean, it's not as immediately obvious as a problem as projecting badness, but it can be a problem because it can lead to this grasping attachment, right? To the extent that we want to stay distant from the members of the first group, we want to really be close to, and even in a sense possess, the members of the second group, right? So we start dealing with all of these multifaceted beings who make up our experience, we start dealing with them as if they were objects. We go into a store, and the store is filled with a lot of different objects, and the salesman, we ask for something, and the salesman brings out an example of it, and we look at it, and we don't like it, and with exaggerations, we say, oh, get that away from me, I don't even want to look at that, you know, bring me something nice. And then the salesman goes back in the back room and picks out something else and shows it to us, and this we like, and say, oh, I gotta have it, you know, right? And so kind of greedy attachment arises to that which we like, you know, and fearful and angry repulsion arises to those things that we don't like. But the judgment of like or dislike is so superficial in most cases. And we get blinded to the fact, for example, we get blinded to the fact that something which on an initial view may not be so attractive may have some value to it. And we very, very easily get blinded to the fact that something that is attractive may have some negative aspects to it. So, for example, have you ever seen an object that you like so much that you have to have it and then you buy it, and then when you get home, You ask yourself, what was I thinking? Why did I buy this? You know, it looked so attractive in the store, you know, with the lights playing on it in the window and the attractive advertisements and the fact that in the advertisement there's very attractive people holding this object. So all their attractiveness seemed to be coming in relationship to this object. And so now I bought it and I brought it home. And now it's just an object. It's just something sitting there, you know. And we ask of it, come on, make me happy. But it's just sitting there on the shelf. It has no ability to do it. Even when it starts performing its necessary function, like if it's clothing and we wear it, and it's a car, we drive it, or it's a machine and we run it, even when it starts performing the function for which we thought we bought it, right? How long does it take before it stops performing that function well? Before it breaks down? Before it goes old? Before it wears out? And pretty soon that object which seemed to promise us all manner of happiness, at least based on how it first appeared and how the advertisements are revealing it, you know, now is just something. Something which has lost its appeal. And that's because we didn't really see that object in its reality. We saw it with a projection of it being permanent and self-existent, right? And that attitude towards an object can easily be our attitude towards beings, towards people, because we can, under the force of this kind of view, start viewing people as objects, you know, objects either to run away from, to get out of my life, or objects to possess, you know? And that's a very, very sad situation, isn't it? You know, when people are in a relationship, it can be a married relationship or any kind of relationship, they're meant to kind of love each other and cherish each other and support each other, but very often what's happening is one person has initially seen that man or that woman, whoever they're having the relationship with, as possessing some kind of real self-existent goodness or beauty, right? Mm-hmm. And now we're expecting that person, who's now present in my life, to make me happy, right? And if I'm not happy, if I'm not satisfied, that person, that man or woman, isn't doing his job, right? And so our relationship with that person is often a conditional one. Like, I'll love you if you make me happy. And if the person stops making us happy, like if the attractive young person that we originally married starts growing into a less than attractive older person, right, then we feel let down. Okay? So it's not really love at all. It's possessiveness. It's what in the Buddhist terminology is sometimes called attachment, desirous attachment. The word attachment can be used in a positive way. I'm not using it in that way now. I'm using it in its negative sense, right? The difference between love and attachment is that true love is the wish for the other person to be happy. You know, that when we see that other person, it automatically something comes up within us that we wish that person had peace of mind, happiness, a sense of well-being, good health. And that's a spontaneous wish that comes from us towards people that we really love. Attachment is expecting something from the other person. It's completely self-referential. It looks like it's directed towards the other person. Oh, I'm attached to my wife. I'm attached to my husband. I'm attached to my boyfriend, my girlfriend, my this, my child, my parent, my whatever. You know, I really love them. You know, I'm so attached to them. But what we really are in love with is our own wish for ourselves to derive something from this relationship, you know? And if the other person is able to fulfill that function, well, then we'll go along with them. Right? But if that person fails us in some way, right, just by simply growing older, you know, or getting sick, or just waking up in the morning in a slightly bad mood, and instead of saying something really nice to us, say something a little bit short and sarcastic, then our hurt feeling is a direct result of the attachment that we felt, not the love that we felt. Right? So anyway, I've gone off on a soapbox here, so I think that's enough. That's enough for me. So take the ball and run with it. Yes. Right here, Joe.
I completely agree with what you're saying about how people form misconceptions of others, and that makes complete sense. And we all do it to one degree or another. But in the four immeasurables, you have equanimity, which is what you were speaking about, and that makes perfect sense. But then you also have, may all sentient beings be free from suffering and the causes of suffering. And what if you witness, and you were talking about a person that you see walking down the street and forming these misconceptions based on what they look like. But what about you are basing your interpretation of somebody based on something harmful they said or something harmful they did towards somebody else? And as Buddhists, we want to alleviate that suffering.
Exactly.
Even if it's not pointed towards us, but towards... So I guess my question is, can we go too far?
Too far in excusing negative actions?
That would be a way to put it.
Okay. Now, these are very, very good points, you know. Developing equanimity and all of the other positive qualities which are meant to be developed along the spiritual path isn't the same as turning a blind eye to harmful behavior. Right? But there's a huge difference between correctly noting that a person has engaged or is engaging in harmful behavior and then thinking that person is harmful. That person is a bad, harmful person. Right? The actions may indeed be harmful, and anything that we can do, if we have the skill and ability to help counteract it, is very positive. You know, like a simple example is parenting a child. If the child behaves in a really nasty way to his brother or his sister, right? As a responsible parent, we don't hide behind equanimity, you know, behind the mistaken notion of equanimity, and say, oh, just, you know, continue teasing and tormenting and torturing your brother or sister, you know. We point out that behavior was mistaken, that it only produces more harm for the other person, for the sibling, but even harm for the tormentor himself or herself, you know. So knowing that we want to help the person diminish and eventually, if we can be an agent for it to reduce and eventually eliminate these negative habits, these negative patterns of behavior which produce suffering for self and others, then we point out, you know, that what you're doing now is harmful. But a lot of times what parents say is, you're a bad child, right? As if the action, the harmful action they did, defines who they are. So pretty soon the child loses any sense that he or she may have ever had of being a multifaceted person, having some good points which arise and some bad points which arise, and identifies solely on one type of behavior. Right? And so we have to make the distinction between making a correct observation that certain behavior is helpful and is to be practiced, and other behavior is harmful and is to be avoided. We have to make a distinction between that view and then projecting a self-existent, solid, unchanging quality onto the very person himself or herself. That person is, and then just fill in the blank. The person is inherently beautiful, inherently ugly, inherently good, inherently bad, whatever it might be. To quote Lama Yeshe, and I've had a chance to quote this a few times since I've been here at the Kadampa Center, Lama Yeshe said, whenever we get a fixed idea about anything, like about a person, their qualities, right? Whenever we have such a fixed idea, we are hallucinating, right? Because take the situation, take the truthful situation where we see someone doing harm, okay? Well, that was just one action that person is engaging in at this time. You know, does that person only do that action all the time? Is it an ingrained quality, an unchanging quality of that person with no other positive qualities behind it? Right? I mean, certain people have certain qualities so strong, the habit is so strong, that it rises up repeatedly again and again and again. But it never reaches the point where it completely obliterates the fact that they are multifaceted, and with proper training and understanding, the positive qualities can be focused on. Okay? So equanimity doesn't mean turning a blind eye to negativity. It means changing the focus away from the person, thinking the person is this way or that way, and therefore reacting to it with hatred, and instead focusing on the behavior, because the behavior can change. Right? And with skill, we can help those people, if they're within our circle, it's possible to help them recognize their good qualities. One last thing I want to say. I was speaking to people who deal with therapy, and they say one form of therapy that they find most effective, if a person comes to the therapist's office and is complaining, oh, I'm like this, I'm like that, I can't do anything, I'm stupid, people don't like me, blah, 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 that whole self-loathing syndrome. One of the aspects of therapy that can be helpful is to draw out from that person a memory or an experience of themselves which is contrary to that image. You know, that somewhere in their life they must have done something at some time that somebody else found good, helpful, bright, intelligent. Because even people with very low self-esteem, in the course of a day, do a bunch of good things, a bunch of admirable things. People on the outside can notice it. The person himself, if they're laboring under this really strong, false self-conception, for them, their good qualities are invisible. Okay. Anyway, something to think about.
Thank you. I really appreciated you using the analogy of the parent and children, because I have three children myself, and certainly they don't always get along, and it's important to teach them, as you said, to teach them that their thoughts and them as a person, they're good people, but the problem is their behavior. When you slug your sister, it's that's not good behavior. And I appreciate you sort of distinguishing the difference between these misconceptions based on the ideas in our head versus their behavior. And I think a lot of people don't think about that, or they merge the two together, and then they just excuse this kind of behavior, which is,
right.
It's a completely different thing. Thank you.
Well, thank you.
I can relate to everything you're saying, and I really work to go the middle way, that place where, you know, you're watching, clearly assessing, and paying attention to all the signals that you're getting. Because one of the things that you said at the very beginning, what do you think causes us to respond so much to a person with a signal of like, you know, repulsion? So some of it is fear, and fear is something that either is real or imagined. But I think the fear is something that needs to be heard in order to discern which one it is.
Yeah.
And I think the other thing that I wanted to kind of ask about is sometimes we talk conceptually here, but then where the rubber hits the road is when you are a parent. And in parenting my own child, I realized that I didn't get a lot of coaching or ability to talk through things about how to pick friends. And as I have a daughter who's now reaching, well, she's 7, she's going on 8, and how early now all the difficulties and drama that happen between kids on the playground, where they need to negotiate and they need to assess and clearly see things, but not be quick to judge one way or another. I think that's a skill that, as an adult, we still, I mean, I know I still have to kind of, you know, rely, you know, work at. Okay, so there's two things that I want to say left. One is, there's this little saying that says, give it time, everyone will surprise you. You know, like sometimes, you know, it's that first impression, but don't dive in head first with it. Just sit with it and have certain type of patience, of like mindful awareness to watch them, to see who they really are, to flush it out, right? And then the other one is, well, how do you teach to discern and not judge, yet make a decision of gently letting that person go their own way with compassion, but they're not going to be in that close, they're not someone that should be close to you. Do you know what I mean? Like, I'm thinking about a little, you know, like just in the playground scenario, this child right now is exhibiting certain behaviors that are not good for you. We hope him well, we wish him well, that he may find what he needs, but this is not where, this is, won't be good for you to have this association. And I use that language, but it's, how do you teach that? You know what I'm saying?
Well, the way you're saying it sounds, you know, if you, the extent to which you can communicate that is very helpful, is very reasonable. You're not saying that kid in the playground is evil, you know, don't spend time with him or anybody who looks like him, you know. We're just saying, notice the behavior. Notice how when this person, this kid does whatever he does habitually, how it makes everybody around him uncomfortable, and it makes him, also him. It brings sadness to his life. So until, you know, we give that person room to grow, but while he's still exhibiting this behavior, it's like a candle flame. Until you know how to deal with fire, it's better to stay away from the flame because it'll burn you. You know, so you're taking the blame language out of it, you're taking the projection language out of it, and just trying to be, you know, realistic. But thank you for that. One thing that came to my mind during your response was these projections that were talked about, especially the negative ones, was tied in that response to fear. So fear is self-protection, isn't it? Right? So all of the hallucinated projections we have about people outside our life, this person is so dangerous, I have to repulse him. This person is so attractive, I have to possess her. You know, all those projections are a reflection of the view that we have of ourself. Right? If we weren't holding on ourself in a hallucinated manner, thinking, I am like this, I am like that. In other words, if we're unaware that we are multifaceted, that we have different qualities, some of which can be improved, some of which better if they were diminished, If we're not aware of that, if we're just painting ourselves in a certain way, holding on to a certain fixed idea of who and what we are, then we're automatically setting ourselves up for fear and repulsion on one hand and greed and attachment on the other. One last thing. I'm married now and also have three children, but they're in their 20s now. But when they were still very young, I was living in a Dharma center, and there was a woman there I admired very much. And I said, "Well, how do you deal with your children when they exhibit a very, very strong negative emotion? You know, like really strong anger or fear or like that." And she says, well, I try to let them know two things. One is that they is to support them in their recognition of what's arising. So if anger is arising or fear is arising or whatever the emotion is, just support them and says, yes, that's what you're feeling. In other words, you really encourage them to have a certain faith that what they observe in the feeling that's arising is an accurate observation, rather than, you know, if it's a negative emotion, saying, no, you're a good person, you don't feel that. Right? You know, denying them their experience. In other words, you support their experience. Because if you don't support their experience, they become very mistrustful, not only of you and other adults, but they can become mistrustful of themselves. They no longer have the faith that they can recognize what's going on in their heart and in their mind. So you support them like that. But together with that, is support them in the recognition of this changes. You know, whatever strong emotion you're having, you are having it. That's true, right? But with time, you'll see, and you have to be skillful about this, right? That it doesn't last. It changes. And therefore, it isn't some kind of permanent thing that they have to labor under. So this gives them an idea of the more fluid nature of their existence, and that they do now have the ability to discern, these are qualities I want to increase, and these are qualities I want to decrease. Some are helpful and some are harmful, right? So just supporting them in their ability to recognize what's happening, and also to recognize that what's ever arising lasts for a while and then changes. So that's quite helpful. The opposite is definitely something that we should try to avoid, even though we fall into this habit all the time with ourselves and with others, and that is coming to a decision, a conclusion, because I feel this, I'm like that. Because I feel the other way, I'm like that. Because the person is speaking this way, he's like that. You know? Because that's denying the fact that we live in a world in which all compounded phenomena are impermanent, as Buddha's last advice was, you know. Okay.
Until what extent everything that happened around us, let's say, facing the behavior of a child or whatever you're facing, is not independent, is because your own reality is facing with this situation.
Yeah.
So at a certain point in time, if we complain, I have this situation with my son, it's the anger. And in one way, we could see that it's independent from us. But I don't know if at this point we are facing this situation because our own reality.
Mm.
So in other words, I don't know, it's kind of fatalism, but we could manage in terms of the thing that are happening to us is because our own internal reality, that we are like a mirror, no, in certain way.
I think that's very, very profound. It brings up the subject of karma and very subtle aspects of karma as well, so it's a little bit beyond what we can get into in any great detail, but we are magnetically drawn into situations because of the energy we ourselves have created in the past, right? So let's say if we're a person who continually encounters people coming up and insulting us, you know, we're the object of other people's insults and sarcasm, you know. There are people like that. They seem to be born under, you know, a dark cloud, and wherever they go, people just take delight in insulting them, or they attract people who are insulting, right? Or any kind of negative behavior. I'll just use insults as an example, right? Well, from one point of view, it seems like the people doing the insulting are the aggressors, and this poor slob is just the recipient of this bad behavior, okay? But from the Buddhist point of view, that person who's constantly attracting that same kind of destructive input, receiving those same kind of messages over and over, must have in the past given that same kind of energy out to others and is now reaping the karmic result of having created that negative energy like an echo. You know, having given out very strongly that negative energy to others has created a karmic situation in which they're magnetically drawing into their life people who are going to react to them in that same way. And then typically what happens is that when we're the recipient of that negative energy, you know, when people are insulting us, and then we get angry, we don't take any responsibility for being in any way responsible for it. You know, I'm just a poor, unfortunate bystander. I'm just an innocent victim of all these people coming up to me, you know, and saying bad things to me. It takes no responsibility for it at all, and therefore it doesn't begin to change one's own behavior. Right? Now, from a recommendation would be, well, if hearing bad language from others, like insults and things like that, is uncomfortable, recognize that it's the result of having given that kind of negative energy out in the past, and then change the kind of energy you're giving out. You know, when you meet with people, see if you can find something nice to say about them, something supportive. Avoid using really heavy sarcasm and harsh language. And it won't change the situation like that, right? Because the other one might have been built up over a long period of time, but it starts changing things around, right? And it takes responsibility for this, what I like to think of as the echo effect, that what happens to our life isn't just some kind of random accident to poor little me. How sad that people are doing all these horrible things to me. It's recognizing if we hadn't given out that kind of energy in the past, we wouldn't be receiving something like that in the present. So let's change the energy that we're giving out. You know? But this brings up another whole vast subject. So maybe there's someone else who had their hands raised who wanted to... way in the back.
One question that kind of came to mind when you were talking about sort of affirming the arising of feelings in another person, like a child.
Yeah.
You know, in the situations like where, you know, lots of folks, we're all in families, there's some mixed marriages and step parents and step sisters, and there's so many relationships that are not biological. They're people that are in relationship with other people that not necessarily by choice, or I just think where you have a step parent who puts up walls because they're afraid of rejection, and so they don't see the love and acceptance of the other people in the family, or like with in-laws, and in trying to when someone has such a fear of rejection that they can't see the love and acceptance of those around them, I find myself in situations where you can't argue somebody into feeling loved or accepted.
Right. Exactly.
If that makes any sense. And, and because it seems like it just makes it worse. Like, oh, you don't, no, everybody really does love you and care about you. And, and I didn't know if you had any thoughts on how to approach that.
Mm. Wow. Yeah. No, that's a very, very real situation and a difficult one, one that I don't feel from my own experience too well qualified to comment on. Maybe someone else from their experience. Oh, is this going to be about chakras?
Yeah.
If it's about chakras, let's leave it. That's too esoteric.
Well, like somebody else said about, you know, that person's life growing up, they might have not been loved by their family members. Mm-hmm. So then they don't know how to give love. I don't have to say chakras. I'm just saying it's how they were brought up. And they don't know how to give love. And it's like a love tank in your heart. If somebody didn't give it to you, how can you give it out?
Right.
You don't have anything left.
And that's what he's saying, but do you have a way of approaching it to help turn that syndrome around? That's kind of the question. Like, what do we do? Having noticed that, that this person has a really strong self-image, which is preventing them from accepting the love that's there, how do we help?
It's healing the wounds of the past, of their past.
I'm sorry?
It's about healing the wounds of their past and how to understand where they come from. And, you know, I can do it my way, but trying to understand how to express it without going too deep.
These questions are really deep questions because there's people that we care about who are tied into knots, you know, that are so tight that we don't really know how or have the skill to help them untie it. You know, I just want to give one example from my experience, and then I'll give out to what other people want to say. There's a married couple that me and my wife are very, very close to. We love very much. The wife comes from a background in which she never received any kind of support or recognition for her good qualities from her father. And therefore, she's an overachiever. You know, she just does everything she can to be as perfect as possible, in a way, to make up for the lack of affirmation that she from her father. I didn't hear that.
The phone made a response that said, "Sorry, I didn't get that."
Oh. Yeah. So, and the only thing that me and my wife and her husband have been able to do, because it's so obvious for us, is just support her in whatever she does. You know, don't get upset if something runs a little bit late. You know, she's always apologizing for being late or apologizing this or that. You know, just let her know that, you know, we don't hold it against her, and instead try to pay attention to the things that she does that we can reflect back to her, you know, and let her know she's doing a good job or well appreciated and so forth. And in the years that we've known her, I mean, this has been many years, right? We've seen a change, right? So it's not something that we can help someone do just in a finger snap, you know. Even working, you know, over a long period of time, the change might be quite slow, right? So that's one of the difficult things, is being patient when our loving wish to help someone isn't producing instant results. But that's also the nature of karma. Right? Yes?
To the gentleman that spoke in the back about not, you know, what can we do to help other people?
Yeah.
One of the things that our teacher said, Geshe-la, had said previously is, if you can't change somebody else's behavior, and the examples were extreme, but just commit to not doing that. And I think that was what you kind of said. Just if they can't accept love, just learn how to accept love and demonstrate that.
Uh-huh.
You know, so it's just accepting and
kind of also and sort of like modeling the behavior.
Being an example of the practice.
Yeah.
I just wanted to say, back kind of to what we were talking about before, about judgment of behavior. Mm-hmm. And one thing that has definitely helped me is to try to, when I see someone doing something that I would disagree with, try to replace that judgment with empathy and try to understand more deeply why they're doing that. I'm not sure if that works well with children, but I'm not really qualified to talk about that. But definitely in interactions with adults, to try to usually people have reasons. They have, you know, reasons for doing the things that they do. And whether or not I think they're right or wrong is probably less important than understanding why they do them, in order to try to understand both them and myself better. So I don't know if that's helpful, but
no, that's very good. And there was also someone in near the back, John. Thank you.
Kind of along the same lines, is like, why are people the way they are? Why do we do things that we do, or think what we do, or feel what we do? And I'm new to Buddhism, so I'm trying to understand all of this stuff. And you mentioned karma, so you have nature and nurture, so we have our genes and we have our upbringing that create who we are. But there's this karma thing that carries over, maybe, from lifetimes to lifetimes. So how does this all play in? Like, where does the karma come in when the egg and the sperm come together and you get your genes from your mother and from your father, and then you have your mother teaching you how to behave and your father teaching you how to behave? Where does the karma come in?
Yeah.
And why are we the way we are? I guess just trying to understand that would solve a lot of this.
Yeah. Well, I like the real simple question. No, I mean, you brought up a lot of amazing points, you know, things that I know students of Buddhism wrestle with for long periods of time. If we just take the Buddhist point of view or approach, or my limited understanding of the Buddhist approach, maybe that's more accurate. The actions that we engage in, the intentional actions that we engage in, for good or for bad, leave impressions on our stream of consciousness that we carry along with us. And if you can accept the fact that our stream of consciousness has no beginning or no end, then what follows from that is that that consciousness goes from lifetime to lifetime. All right? And I want to add, that was not an easy thing at all for me to even get wrap my own mind around, so I don't expect anyone else to buy into it immediately. But from the Buddhist point of view, karma is something which can, the karmic impulse can carry from one life to another. And when it ripens, when a karmic impulse ripens, it's like a seed that's planted on the stream of consciousness. When it meets the appropriate situations and that seed ripens, it ripens it's often described as in four ways in terms of how we experience its result. Right? So maybe that's what I should talk about, because I think that starts to answer that question, and maybe it would be helpful, at least as an introduction to this area. Okay. So, first of all, just the overall shape, and just to repeat what you've probably heard before quite a number of times, if the karmic seed planted on our consciousness is planted from a harmful action, motivated by one of the delusions, like hatred and jealousy and attachment and so forth, then when that seed, when that impression ripens, it ripens in an unwanted experience, experience of uneasiness, of suffering, of pain. Okay? Whereas the seeds that are planted from a positive action, like we do or say something helpful to out of love and compassion for somebody else, well, that also plants a seed. You know, we shouldn't think of it as a physical seed. That's just an analogy. We're kind of programming this ongoing computer of our mind in such a way that when that seed, when that impression ripens, it ripens in an experience of happiness, well-being, peace of mind. So the overall shape of karma is quite simple. Good leads to good, bad leads to bad, you know. Help leads to happiness, harm leads to suffering. Okay? That's the general shape. But specifically, how a karmic impression or karmic seed, how it ripens, it can ripen in any of four different ways, and often in a series of these four different approaches, results, I should say. Okay. Let's think of a particularly strong karmic action. In other words, let's say killing somebody with great anger. Okay? So the action is harmful and it's motivated by a particularly violent delusion. Okay? That's something which, if it's not purified from the mind, sooner or later can thrust one into a whole realm of experience. So that when we're reborn, we're not reborn in an environment which is conducive to happiness, but one in which our very body is an enemy to happiness and well-being. Okay? So that's what they call like the fully ripened result. You know, rebirth in a realm of great suffering. Right? Now, afterwards, I mean, that's not permanent. So eventually that experience in that realm is exhausted, and we may find ourselves again in the human realm, you know, reborn from the sperm and the egg of human parents. Okay? Now, we still carry with us the impression of that seed. It's not, hasn't been completely exhausted yet, so it's still there. So now the karma is ripening in the experiences of that human life. And some of those experiences are... So for example... some of those experiences are what happens to us. So, for example, if the karma was of killing, giving great harm to someone else, then we might be born into a family and into a situation where we're abused. Right? So that's a further result of karma. We're a human being now, but we're being treated in a very harmful way as a result, again, as a further result of the harm that we had created in the past. So that karma ripens in that lifetime as experiences that we have. But it can also ripen as our tendencies. So, for example, if the karma is one of sadistically harming someone else, we may be born as a child who still has sadistic tendencies. Like among children, you know, despite, and this is quite separate from the parenting that they receive. You know, parents can have a whole bunch of children, and some of them have a natural tendency towards compassionate actions, and some have a natural tendency towards harmful actions. You know, parents observe that all the time, you know, even from the same kind of general gene pool. It doesn't determine everything. Some kids come in with certain tendencies in one direction or another. And this karmic result, the karmic tendency to repeat the same kind of behavior that originally planted the negative karmic seed, is considered the most harmful of all the results of karma, right? Because instead of just being something that happens to us and then can be finished with, it's something which perpetuates the same behavior over and over again. And then finally, the fourth result of karma can be in the very environment in which we're born. So we might live in a situation where the environment mitigates against our happiness in one way or another. So I think what we could say is that yes, the parents have different genes, and we don't have exactly the same genes as our brothers and sisters. It changes, but this only affects this affects kind of that inward environment that we're born into. Why did we receive those genes? You know, karma would be an explanation of why we receive that kind of genetic material which predisposes us to this kind of behavior or that kind of behavior. But it's the karma itself which is the main ingredient. Right? So karma is not exactly the same as our genetic upbringing, and it's not completely separate from it. They work together. Because any experience we have is the result of a whole bunch of factors coming together. And actually, that's the only point I really wanted to make. was that it's very, very hard to discern from an experience we're having, what the single cause is that brought it about. Because generally speaking, there is no single cause. There may be a predominant cause, you know, like having committed murder in the past might be the predominant cause of why people are attacking us physically in this life. But it's not the only cause, because we've, you know, karma is a singular word, my karma. But actually, it should be my karmas, because we have tons and tons of impressions from tons and tons of different actions that we have. So any one result is the end result of a number of causes coming together. Primary causes, contributory conditions, and so forth. So that's why I said in the beginning that it's a really, really big question that you ask, you know, why is this happening to me? Because we want to come up with a singular answer. This is happening for this reason. But in fact, it's a whole bunch of reasons, some stronger than others, collected over a long period of time, which bring as the end result whatever experience we're having. Okay? So I know this isn't a terribly, completely satisfying answer, but maybe within it there's some clues of areas that you can explore to kind of tease it out a little bit. Okay? This will be the last one, because we're reaching the end of our time. Yeah. We need a microphone right here. Joan?
Thank you.
Yeah.
I just have a quick question. So when these karmas arise, or these seeds ripen, I mean, this gives us an opportunity in itself, doesn't it?
An opportunity?
To clear, or yeah, to try and... Can you speak to that?
Yeah, the question is, we've planted a karmic seed on our consciousness. Now it's ripening because we've met with certain conditions. Doesn't that give us a chance then to exhaust that karma? It does. It depends on how we react with it, and it depends on how strong that impression was. For example, we might do an action which is so strong that it produces not just one lifetime of suffering, but it may project several consecutive lifetimes of suffering. So we're exhausting part of that karma by having that suffering, but we're not exhausting all of it. Okay, so that's one thing, depending on its strength. Also, even if the experience of that karma would be sufficient to exhaust it, you know, even if it would be, our reaction to that experience might reinvent it again, you know? So like if I'm walking down the street and someone bumps into me rather violently, knocks me to the ground, right? If I'm clever enough and quick-witted enough to think, okay, I just exhausted the karma that I must have created by just mindlessly bumping into somebody in the past. And then it's like I'm exhaling, like letting go. But if I raise myself off of the sidewalk and I say, oh, you SOB, I'm going to get back at you for that, like that, then I may have exhausted the negative karma, but I'm simultaneously creating the same negative karma again by the reaction. So that's another thing to keep in mind. And this will be the last thing I wanted to mention, because we brought up, you know, children, raising children came up on several different questions or comments here. One of the pieces of advice that I received that I think was the most helpful was that when a child does something, you know, that is negative, you know, harmful, and when we're helping them understand what they did and be realistic about it and so forth, it's always helpful to have reinforced the idea that no matter what arises in their experience, no matter what arises in their mind, on the deepest level of their being, there's clarity. You know, in Buddhist terms, there's the Buddha nature. There's the potential of achieving a state of being which is free from all the delusions and is filled with loving kindness, compassion, and wisdom. That we have, like for kids, we could use the idea that we have a light within us Now, when negative things arise, it's not as if the light goes out. It's just that it's obscured. It's been covered. And it might be covered very thickly. But I think it's really helpful to let children know that no matter how bad they're feeling, no matter how many harmful things they may have done to their brothers and sisters, no matter any of the negativity that's surrounded in their life, the most it has done is just temporarily obscured this light of innate goodness that's within them, this potential for enlightenment, right? And if we can kind of reinforce that idea, then kids can accept the fact that a negative mood has arisen or a harmful action has arisen without them thinking, I'm fundamentally bad. Because fundamentally, there is this clear light, you know, this radiance, this potential for enlightenment. And I think of all the ways of encouraging children, even, in my opinion, much better than trying to indoctrinate them with a particular religion, you know, is just indoctrinate them with the idea that there's something fundamentally radiant about your heart, about your mind. It can be obscured. It happens, right? And we can model that ourselves, like when we lose our temper, right? Then when we come back to ourselves, you know, just demonstrate that, okay, that mood passed, and when it passed, it didn't destroy the innate goodness. And so that gives them a kind of foundation that can be built on. So anyway, I just wanted to add that at the end. I've forgotten. We have some concluding things to do? Okay.
Okay. Please turn to page 246 in the Gold Prayer Book for Master Shantideva's dedication. May all beings everywhere, plagued by sufferings of body and mind, obtain an ocean of happiness and joy by virtue of my merits. May no living creature suffer, commit evil, or ever fall ill. May no one be afraid or belittled with a mind weighed down by depression. May the blind see forms and the deaf hear sounds. May those whose bodies are worn with toil be restored on finding repose. May the naked find clothing, the hungry find food. May the thirsty find water and delicious drinks. May the poor find wealth, those weak with sorrow find joy. May the forlorn find hope, constant happiness, and prosperity. May there be timely rains and bountiful harvests. May all medicines be effective and wholesome prayers bear fruit. May all who are sick and ill quickly be freed from their ailments. Whatever diseases there are in the world, may they never occur again. May the frightened cease to be afraid and those bound be freed. May the powerless find power and may people think of benefiting each other. As long as space remains, for as long as sentient beings remain, until then may I too remain to dispel the miseries of the world. And seven Tara mantras. Hello. So I'm Jill, the center manager. I just have a few brief announcements. We have had some changes in some management positions that we've been looking for, so I just wanted to welcome the newest member, embarrass her. Her name's Arlene Van Rickingham. She doesn't know I'm going to say that. She's our new bookstore manager, so if you give her a round of applause for taking this position. And you can raise your hand or stand as you feel comfortable. There she is. It's very important to have this position filled, so I'm excited to be working with her. She'll be part of the management team, bringing her wisdom and joy to the team, so very happy about that. The other person who has filled the communications coordinator role, which is really an amazing role, she's not here, so I'm going to keep you in suspense. We're going to be looking for some other new roles. I'm going to announce just one today. I don't think Joey here today? So he's going to be leaving the facilities manager position in January. And I would like to just put it out there for you to be thinking about if you're interested in the role or if you have a secret person you'd like to tell me who you know would be perfect for it so that I can call them and, you know, work on them. I thought maybe if we could get an assistant for a while until January, somebody could assist Joey. Then they could move into the position, and then another assistant to assist the assistant that was the assistant. That would be amazing. So if we could have some of these ideas happening and bubbling up right now, that would be super, because we're going to really need it. Joey's done an immeasurable amount of work for two years or 5 years? How long has he been? Seems like 16. Yeah. But so we need some help in that department. Also, there's a new thing that just happened. So how many received the exciting new email for our online community yesterday? Or was it Friday? Not a lot. So that's up and running now. Dave Strievel and I have been working tirelessly to get it going. And so next week you'll get an invitation on how to sign on and get yourself. It's all the push technology versus the enabling. So we are not going to be enabling you anymore. You have to take it on yourself to put your children in there, pictures. It's very exciting. Right now, the most exciting thing you can do is new text giving. So if you've ever heard of text to give, it is so simple. It's just beautiful. So the minimum thing you can give is $3. So if everybody wants to try it out today, that would just be great. You'll see a drop-down menu, and the first thing is General Donna, and after that, other things are an option like visiting teacher. So we can donate to that category. There's a sign in the back for it, and there's a sign in the communications wall. You just type a number in, and if you're like me, you're like, how does that work? You type a number in like you're calling somebody, and then you text the message KC108, which I think sounds like smooth jazz. I thought that would be kind of fun, KC108. And then you can just be giving that easy. And the next time you do it, all your information's in there, so you just type your amount and say send. So it's really quite exciting. Other than that, yes, it's very easy to slip up and add some extra zeros in there. So, Robbie's next.
Okay. Thank you, Jill. And one announcement. I just wanted to remind people that on the Friday, Saturday, and Sunday after Thanksgiving, there's going to be a 3-day mini Lom Rim retreat here. That's from 7 to 5 each day. This is a practice that's been highly recommended by Lama Zopa Rinpoche. And the only requirement is that you commit to do all 3 days. We don't want people coming in and out. And there will be no regular Sunday teaching on the Sunday after Thanksgiving because we're going to respect the privacy of the retreat for those who are doing it. So easy way to really review the whole path. So we encourage everyone to attend. No pre-registration is necessary. Just show up Friday morning at 7 o'clock and be ready to go. And then, of course, I want to thank John for these wonderful teachings. The clarity and the experience that you bring to him is just overwhelming. Our only request is that you not wait 20 years to come back again. So we're going to form a line here if people would like to offer katas to John as a thank you for the teachings he's given us and to strengthen that connection that Kadampa Center has with him. You're welcome to do that. Kadampa Center is making a financial offering to John, and if you'd like to be part of that, you can just put a donation in the offering boxes that will cover the offering that we make to him and the expenses of putting these teachings on. First class travel from the West Coast, a private driver, lodging in the finest hotel in Raleigh. It all adds up. So if you can help us cover our expenses, that's greatly appreciated. So thank you, everyone.